New Orleans is known for many things, such as jazz, gumbo, Daniel Bryan winning at WrestleMania, but it's also known for an axeman who wanted nothing but to kill and also to play jazz. This is the story of the Axeman of New Orleans. Welcome to Enter the Dark. Hello and welcome to Enter the Dark. I am Jan. With me as always is the man who's always caffeinated, vaccinated and freshly masturbated. It's Les. How's it going, mate?
It's all good, man. It's all good.
Right then, before we get started, let's give our Patreon shout-outs. We have Hannah Blue Harrington, Amanda Champagne, Astoria Crowley, Amy Emmer and Jack Coleman, Sasha Johnson, Lisa Dempsey, Marie T. Jensen, Casey the Cannibal, Misty Day, Becky Louise, Izzy from the Clink, Jules Henderson, Mr. Crow, Richard Vaccarelli, and Michelle Hudson. Thank you all for supporting us. If you do wish to support us, you can do so on Patreon by going to patreon.com/enterthedark, where you can just pledge some money, help us get these out quicker, buy things, and also get Les into rehab. So, tonight we have... I'm only joking about Les getting into rehab, he'll never do it. We have the Axeman of New Orleans. Now... another bit of a history one for you there, here, Les. You're looking forward. Yeah. You like a bit of history.
This one, I'm quite sure. He was in American Horror Story, wasn't he? The one in the set in the Asylum. I think it was series.
Possibly.
Two.
Yeah, I haven't seen Asylum for ages.
He was played by that guy who was the head vampire in 30 Days of Night.
Yeah, that dude.
I don't know. He was also in that god awful. Fucking first Wolverine film.
Yeah. If you know, guys, let us know because it would be interesting.
Yeah, I'm quite sure it was him.
Yeah, let us know because it'd be interesting to find out. But yeah, let's get into this, Les. So let's head down to New Orleans, as we all know.
Gonna have some gumbo and some poor boys.
Well, I don't know, but Principal Skinner in The Simpsons said he was from New Orleans because that's how people say it when you're from New Orleans. It's New Orleans.
Because of Cajun.
It is, yes. Well, Andrew Maggio, he was a barber in the city of New Orleans, and he had just received his draft notice. It was May the 22nd, 1918, and World War I was on everyone's mind, as it would be, because it was the Great War at the time.
The Great War.
It was Great War. All other wars before that, they were all right.
They were all right. They were mediocre wars.
Yeah, this one was great. World War II come along, they were like, this one's great. Can't call it Great War. Let's call it World War I and World War II. Yeah. Not so great, though.
I mean, when you consider it as well, I guess, like, the Napoleonic War was, like, the first World War, really.
But, well, any war's great, Les.
War, what is it good for?
Absolutely nothing, apart from profiteering for companies. But Andrew wasn't too keen on going to war because, you know, he's got a mind and thinking, I don't want to be fucking shot. You know, fucking trenches, mustard gas, rickets. Fuck that. So he went out drinking. I mean, I'm sober, but if I was going to war, I'd probably be like, do you know what? Fuck this. I need a drink.
I'd be drinking during war. Somebody did call me a weapon.
He did, yeah. You are a weapon, though. When he returned just before 2 o'clock in the morning to the place he shared with his brother Jake, he noticed nothing unusual. But then he wasn't much in of a condition to notice anything at all. And that would soon come back to haunt him. Compared to what he was about to experience, a draft notice would seem like a mosquito's bite to a shark attack. See what's in there? Like, little, that hurts us. Ah, you fucking bastard, you took a chunk out my arm.
Ah, we could need a bigger boat.
Yeah, man. Jake and Andrew's rooms adjoined the home of their married brother, Joseph Maggio, and his wife, Catherine. As Robert Tallant, a novelist and acknowledged authority on the Axeman, indicates, on the morning of May the 23rd, Jake woke up around 4 a.m. He realised he'd been startled awake by noises that sounded like groaning that were coming through the wall from the room where Joseph and his wife slept. He got up and knocked on the wall to get their attention, but failed to get a response, so he knocked louder. Again, nothing. Now, if you've got a room next to your married brother and his wife and you hear groaning, you're not going to knock on the wall, are you? Go, what are you doing in there?
Are you going to be
everything
like,
okay?
Good lad, he's filling his boots.
He was now worried, though. Maybe. He was just sort of like, them two never have sex. He was now worried, though. He tried to arouse Andrew, not like that, Lennox, just arouse him out of his sleep. But he had difficulty since Andrew was inebriated. Finally, Jake got him up.
Yeah. Got him up. Right.
Together, they ventured into Joseph's home.
You know.
And to their alarm, they found evidence of a break-in.
Oh.
A wooden panel had been chiseled out and removed from the kitchen door. It lay on the ground, discarded chisel on top of it.
That's got to take a while.
Yeah, you know, chiseling it out and, you know, people could hear that, couldn't they?
Damn chiselers. I love that phrase, you're a chiseler.
I've never heard that phrase before in my life. No one's ever said to me, you fucking chiseler.
Forget what it means now, but they used it in Gangs of New York.
They got in the house via the kitchen, skirted around the bathroom and entered Joseph's room. He was on the bed, his legs draped over the side, and Catherine lay partially over him. When Joseph saw his brothers, he tried to rise, but fell over, half out of bed. They ran to check on him and found he was barely alive, with deep bloody gashes on his head. Catherine was already dead, lying in a pool of blood. They called the police immediately. Corporal Arthur Hattener arrived first, just ahead of the ambulance, but it was too late. Joseph was dead. As Hattener waited for backup, he questioned the Maggio brothers and then looked around for clues. That sounds cool though, doesn't it? The Maggio brothers.
The Maggio brothers, it does.
He's like, hey, I'm fucking Arthur Hattener. Who are you? We're the fucking Maggio brothers. Oh!
Oh! Oh! Hey! It's
fucking New Orleans, but we speak about we're from New York. Oh! The Times Picayune newspaper read the story on its front page, it's not what it's called, but I'm naming it, on its front page that morning, including a photograph of the death chamber. The bedroom in the home where the Maggios had lived behind the store. Married 15 years, they were grocers operating a small store in the barroom on the corner of Upper Line and Magnolia Street. An investigation of the crime allowed the police to deduce that brutal double homicide must have happened just before dawn. Right, I know we give the police a bit of shit here, but they're both dead, both with fucking big gashes in them, and the brothers said they found them before dawn. That's not fucking Sherlock Holmes level of detective, that's just listening to what the Maggio brothers said, and then fucking reciting that.
Imagine that, it's like, we found them before dawn. Well, let me tell you.
It was a double homicide.
It was a double homicide, and I deduce that it occurred just before dawn.
Oh, fucking hell. New Orleans police. Looking around the bloody scene, Officer Hattener discovered a pile of men's clothing in the middle of the bathroom floor. Inside the cast iron bathtub, he spotted an axe leaning against one side. From all appearances, it had been hastily washed clean of blood, although some still clung to the blade and the tub. Back in the bedroom, Hattener made another discovery, a straight razor, such as Barber uses, you know, one of the big ones.
Oh yeah, them big, like, cut razors, all Sweeney Todd and shit.
It was lying in blood on the bed. Reconstructing the crime, he believed that the killer had entered the home by chiselling out a panel in the rear door. No shit.
Yeah.
The murderer then went directly into the bedroom. With an axe, he struck Mrs. Maggio in the head, then used a razor to slice through her throat, nearly severing her head.
Jesus Christ. Yeah, he fucking them things are sharp. No shit, Sherlock.
Well, they're called cutthroat razors. You cut your throat with them. He also hit Joseph Maggio with the same axe. Since Joseph was sprawled half out of bed, it seemed like the killer might have struck him last. But given Catherine's position on top of him, it could have been the other way around. The events weren't clear. However, it was obvious that the killer also had used the razor on Joseph before discarding it. The coroner arrived and gave a quick estimate of the time of death between 2 and 3 in the morning. The victims were removed as a crowd gathered around to watch. A woman who lived nearby stepped forward to tell investigators that she had seen Andrew outside during the early morning hours. Jake and Andrew were taken into custody for questioning. They swore they were innocent, but were locked up anyway. Jake was released the following day, but Andrew remained in prison. Then the police learned that the razor used to cut open the throats of Joseph and Catherine Maggio belonged to Andrew. The plot thickens here. One of his employees had seen him remove it at the same day from his barbershop at 123 South Rampart Street. Visibly nervous, he admitted that he brought it home to repair a nick in it. Things looked bad for Andrew, with two witnesses and significant piece of physical evidence implicating him. On May the 26th, 2 days after his arrest, he gave an interview to the Times Picayune newspaper to the effect that he had suffered so much from his arrest. It's a terrible thing to be charged with the murder of your own brother when your heart is already broken by his death. when I'm about to go to war too. I had been drinking.
All right, it's all right. Right.
I know, yeah. Well, my brother's dead. I'm getting
you're laying it on thick there.
I had been drinking heavily. I was too drunk even to have heard any noise next door.
Well, I had a hangover and I'm going to war. Fucking man up.
To be fair, Andrew, if you get charged for this, mate, you're not going to war.
No.
Are you? Not going to go, right, you're guilty of your brother and your sister-in-law's murder. Off to war you go. Although he had not mentioned it before, he did say that he'd noticed a man going into his brother's house around 1:30 a.m. when he'd come home. But the police didn't believe him. I wouldn't, because you haven't mentioned this bit of evidence before, have you?
No. And all you've done is moan before that.
I'm going to war.
I'm going to war. And, I'm so heartbroken.
They had found the door to the safe in Joseph's house open and the safe was empty, which indicated a robbery. But money under Joseph's pillow and found in drawers was left behind, along with Catherine's jewellery wrapped and placed beneath the safe. A black tin box, empty, was found in one corner. The brothers said that Joseph always kept the safe locked, and there was no sign that the door had been forced open. Investigators determined that the axe had belonged to the victims, and they believed that the killer was familiar with the layout of the house. The coroner carefully examined the wounds to the descendants, and in Joseph's case, the axe had been the primary weapon involved in his death, breaking through his skull, while Catherine's throat had been slit open from ear to ear with the razor. A few days after the bodies were found, Andrew was released from prison. Despite the witnesses, there was insufficient evidence against him, and soon another discovery would point to a different suspect, one who had eluded police before. About a block away from the small grocery store where the Maggios were murdered, two detectives came across a strange message written on the sidewalk in chalk. Mrs. Maggio will sit up tonight like Mrs. Tony.
Who's Mrs. Tony?
They carefully copied it, although different sources report the wording differently. One says, just write Mrs. Tony. But the newspapers... Just write Mrs. Tony. But the newspapers reported the first one. The writing resembled that of a schoolboy and it seemed an important clue. But at that moment, no one was sure what to make of it. Some said it had been written by an accomplice to warn the killers that Mrs. Maggio was on guard. After some digging, they eventually spotted a possible connection to earlier crimes in the area. In 1911, 7 years earlier, there had been either two or three incidents of horrendous axe murders. The supposed targets were Italian grocers. Since all of the couples had been grocers, Italian, asleep in bed and killed with an axe after the break-in through a panel in the back door, police deduced there was a link.
Yeah.
Although all three incidents were unsolved. I'm not saying I'm a criminologist. I mean, I've just got a YouTube channel, /podcast. But if I've got three couples, all Italian grocers, all murdered with an axe, all in New Orleans, all gained entry by somebody chiselling out a wooden frame in the door, I'm going to go so far as to say, you know what? I think there's a link here.
It's like, oh well, but we've got Mardi Gras to fucking prepare for.
According to reports, which could be nothing more than folklore, detectives puzzled over the names from the scribbled messages to try and discern a connection. According to Tallant, the first victim's name was Crutti, no wife, the second Rossetti, killed with his wife, and the third, Chiambre, also killed with his wife. The latter man's first name was Tony, so Tallant says the police wondered if they had some connection with Mrs. Tony of the enigmatic chalk message. Perhaps it was the woman rather than the men who were targeted. It wasn't long before people in the Italian community began to talk about a possible connection with the mafia. These people had been Italian and perhaps they had not paid their dues.
So it was the mafia.
Perhaps they borrowed money and failed to meet their obligations. The mafia was known to teach people lessons for such perceived effrontery. A few Italian citizens of New Orleans requested police protection. Some whispered about an organisation called the Black Hand. A mafia splinter group.
Ooh, that's cool.
Yeah. A mafia splinter group believed in 1911 to have been responsible for a spate of killings.
Hold on, though. Like, wasn't the Black Hand, wasn't that the group that, like, assassinated Franz Ferdinand, which basically kicked off
World War One,
yeah.
I'm not sure, was it?
I'm quite sure they were called the Black Hand.
Like... I know the Black Hand was a mafia thing, like, if you didn't, you'd get a black hand left. Like, a card with a black hand on it. And that means you're fucking dead.
Yeah. Weirdly as well, like, in piracy, the black spot was like a death mark. Similar sort of parallels. But yeah, I'm sure that group, was like, yeah, oh, is he looking it up?
Yeah.
Like, I'm quite sure, like, the guy who assassinated Franz Ferdinand was part of an organisation called the Black Hand.
Yeah, this was, the Black Hand did. It was the Black Hand Society.
Serbian, weren't they?
Serbian, yeah. So I don't think it's got anything to do with the Black Hand Mafia.
But
Black Hand Serbians, there you go. Yeah, well done, Les.
History, yeah, history episode, isn't it?
Yeah. So, there was a time in New Orleans where organized crime was the dominant force, to the point where much blood had been shed. In 1890, a group of mafia assassins were believed to have gunned down police chief David Hennessy, as described in the book Gumbo Yaya, just steps from his home. Good name, innit?
Yeah.
Gumbo Yaya. Supposedly, he arrested a mafia leader and had threatened to expose the criminal records of others at an approaching trial. They could not allow him to testify. Suspects were arrested, but the trial's jury members were threatened and bribed, so one by one, each of the men got off. The citizens of New Orleans were incensed at the outcome. They formed a mob, marched on the prison to find those who were left inside, and lynched 11 men that they believed were responsible for the crime. This was done to make a statement to organised crime rather than to exact justice against a specific man. The citizens were tired of being pushed around and having their elected officials endangered or corrupted. However, organised crime remained and the Black Hand was still a secretive force in 1911. Now, the society was called that because those who didn't comply with its demands received notes imprinted with a Black Hand to warn them of terrible reprisals. Many Italians were expected to give up portions of their wages to the criminal group, and if they didn't, they would be harassed or killed. It was believed that the Black Hand offered an assassination school for those who swore loyalty to the society, and there they learned how to intimidate people. Not to assassinate people, just intimidate.
Just
call it an intimidation school, really, shouldn't they? Skill, push people, going, oh! Oh!
It's not exactly the doing fucking that with the League of Shadows, is it? Like,
no.
That's pretty wank. It's like, I've come here to learn how to kill. Whoa, whoa, whoa.
Don't run before you can walk.
Don't run before.
Intimidate.
So first, what you do is you get the person and you say, Luke, you, if you don't pay up, I'll give you good hiding.
That's the most British fucking way of saying it. Scruff your ear, young man. While many said that the Black Hand had been squashed with a series of trials in the Midwest in 1907, the Italian community feared that members were still at large. Since the murder of the Maggios was so similar to the 1911 series, there was talk of a resurgence of organised crime, and those rumours would grow and get worse as more events occurred. On August the 5th, a businessman named Edward Schneider had worked after hours at his office. He returned home that evening, expecting his pregnant wife to meet him at the door. They were expecting a baby shortly and he wanted to be there to support her. However, when he opened the door, the place was quiet. Too quiet, Les.
Too quiet?
He called for his wife, but received no response. Looking around with growing apprehension, he came into the bedroom. There on the bed lay his wife, covered in blood. She had a gaping head wound and some of her teeth were knocked out.
Oh my goodness.
Edward ran to her and discovered that she was still alive, so he summoned the police and an ambulance. Mrs. Schneider lay in hospital for a few days in critical condition, but eventually returned to consciousness. When pressed, however, she could not recall many details of the attack. She had been taken a nap, she explained, and had woken to see a dark figure looming over her. Then the axe came down and that was all she remembered. Fortunately, the attack did not affect her pregnancy, and she remained in hospital and a week later gave birth to a healthy daughter. When the newspapers ran the story, they spread fear in the populace by asking in bold headlines, "Is an axeman at large in New Orleans?"
I don't know.
Don't know. There's a lot of axe murders going on. You know, place a bet on yes. Axes and chisels were found outside several people's homes, and a few claimed they had frightened away a potential intruder. Had you, or are you just trying to get your name in the paper?
I've frightened away this axeman. You notice, though, he seems to be like, he's got to be like, this is an expensive endeavour for him.
He's leaving axes and chisels
axes
everywhere.
Axes and chisels everywhere. Exactly, that's what my thoughts. It's like, surely they should just like go around to like hardware stores and be like, so, is there somebody who comes in quite regularly buying, yes, the man who buys the axes and chisels. Lovely bloke.
Yeah. Keeps losing his axes and chisels.
It's a bit absent-minded, but oh, God, you know, he'd do anything for you.
I mean, We're not doing the police's job for him. In 5 days after the Schneider attack, on August the 10th, another woman was confronted by a dark figure in her home. Pauline and Mary Bruno were awakened early by the sound of loud thumps that seemed to be coming from their Uncle Joseph's room.
Oh, goodness.
Pauline sat up and saw the tall, dark figure right there in her room, standing over her bed. So she screamed. Whoever the tall man was, he turned and ran from the house. I'm going to say he isn't all that, because unless he's forgot his axe. Did everyone have an axe those days? Was it like a microwave? Not like you'd cook with it, but, you know.
Well, you'd sort of would cook with it in the respect that, like, you'd be chopping wood, surely.
Yeah, but you wouldn't cook with an axe,
would you? Cook with an axe, but you'd chop in the wood to make the fire.
That's like saying I cook with a knife. I don't do it, Les.
No. You know what I mean. But it's part of the cooking utensils, isn't it?
No, it's an axe.
It's an axe, okay. Yeah, no, you're right. What I just said was was monumentally stupid.
It was. You bellend. The girls later said it seemed as if he had wings. He was awfully light on his feet, she told a reporter. He didn't have wings, did he? You screamed and he fucking ran because Uncle Joseph's fucking stirring. In response to her scream, Joseph Romano came to her room, but he was in no condition to offer assistance. His nightshirt was covered in blood from gashes to his face. I don't know who did it, he told Pauline. It's like,
He's
like, I don't know who's done it. I'm covered in blood. I've got gashes on my face. He instructed her to call the charity hospital with his last breath. He collapsed to the floor, died 2 days later. Or, as some people would say, half an hour later. Bit of a difference there, isn't there?
That's a rather confused report.
Yeah, he died 2 days later. Other reports say half an hour. Now, we'll fucking make your mind. Just say, cover the bases, say 12 hours.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know.
Or, just like be vague, he died sometime after.
Upon investigation, the door panel had been chiselled out and an axe was left in the yard. Yet Romano, while Italian, was not a grocer, but a barber, and his room appeared to have been ransacked. Now,
probably after another razor.
Or, if he's got gashes in his face, he might have ransacked his room coming out. He's heard Pauline scream. He's in his nightshirt. He's in no state help Pauline, is he? He's trying to get around. He's got blood in his eyes, knocking everything over.
He could have done it by accident himself, like gone for pick up like a newspaper that he's rolled up. And been like, oh, ow, my hand, but, oh, God, my face, gah, bumbling around in the dark. It's plausible.
That's fucking Naked Gun kind of shit, isn't it?
To be honest, I've had nights like that. They like the wine, do they, Italians? That's not racist, they just do. They make good wine.
Now the people of New Orleans were terrified. Clearly a killer was at large who managed to break into people's homes while they were sleeping. The citizens were on the lookout for a mysterious figure.
That was their description.
It's a mysterious figure.
Just look out for a mysterious figure. What, in fucking New Orleans? It's like people with mysterious figures.
Reports
do voodoo round here.
Yeah, but people flooded the offices of the police with reports. Of course they would. There were supposed sightings all over the city. One man, a grocer, found a wood chisel on the ground outside his door. Another told of a panel gouged out of his door and an axe lying in the yard. Another, upon hearing sounds, shot through the door, and when the police came, they found signs of someone chipping at the back door. That guy's a hero. He's like, hear this. Fucking shoot first, ask questions later. He's like, fuck this shit. It was actually his dog trying to get in. It wasn't, Les, before you say, was it? Was the dog okay?
No, that's hilarious. Can you imagine the police turn up? There's this fucking Doberman with his head just, like, exploded. It's so, like, we think we know, like that.
The Doberman's looking at him going, I don't know who did this to me.
Me. The police are like, well, it could have been him. I don't see a connection here.
But as most people know, New Orleanians are very good at storytelling, and it was difficult for investigators to determine who was telling the truth and who was looking for attention. They'd even heard about the Axeman, as he was now commonly called, wandering around dressed as a woman.
What?
Yeah, it was just apparently they were like, I saw this Axeman. He was dressed as a woman. And also, my wife. It's like, you're just trying to get your wife arrested, aren't you, so you can carry on with your affair. Yeah. From what they could determine, though, this intruder left no fingerprints, and there was no clear pattern among the victims. They seemed to have picked at random, but most, not all, were grocers. Police wondered if this was the work of a single degenerate or several different people. One policeman had a theory. In 1886, lads, Scottish author Robert Louis Stevenson had published the tale of an upstanding citizen who takes a secret elixir that changes him into a rampaging madman.
Oh, Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde.
That secret elixir was Buckfast wine. Inspired by a dream, the tale follows the monster's attacks. No one suspects Dr. Jekyll, who is in fact guilty, since by all appearances, he's a normal professional man. The short book created an international sensation, and over a century later, it's still referenced when investigators want to describe someone who appears to function with two opposing personalities, one good and one evil. They'd even heard about it in New Orleans. Dr. Joseph D'Antonio, who had investigated the Axe murders in 1911 and then subsequently retired, made reference to this type of person when interviewed by the local papers. "Students of crime," he said, "have established that a criminal of the dual personality type may be a respectable law-abiding citizen. Then suddenly, the impulse to kill comes upon him and he must obey it." To D'Antonio's mind, the recent spate of attacks was linked to those that he had investigated. He believed the man could live respectfully for a decade and then suddenly have the impulse again. Sorry, Les was laughing there because I was pretending I was pulling on braces.
It was fucking like, brilliant.
You know, just sort of like, "No, I ain't one of these big fancy city lawyers. I don't know these words or even how to read."
It's just so funny. The way you did it, it's like you were proper invested in
character. What that meant to people who followed this line of thought was that the killer was more or less invisible, living and working right alongside his potential victims. No one would be the wiser. In fact, there seemed to be something almost supernatural about his ability to get in and out of places and even to be seen without a single victim recalling any clear details. It wasn't possible to go arrest a dark, looming figure. Now, I don't know what's supernatural about chiselling out a fucking wooden door frame, door panel. That's not supernatural.
No, no. It's not even good carpentry.
It'd be...
Why didn't they check out carpenters, actually?
They might have done. But, you know, it's not supernatural, is it, that you've... Like, it'd be supernatural if everywhere was locked and...
They'd found him drained of blood.
Yeah.
And there was no blood anywhere. Like, that's supernatural. Not like, so somebody's chiseled out a bit of door.
Hit him with an axe and slit throat with a razor. That's not supernatural.
And then been absent-minded enough to leave the tools of his trade behind.
Yeah. But yeah.
I love how this motherfucker's, like, got the audacity to be like... Like, so, like, I'm not saying it was Dr. Jekyll. But it was Dr. Jekyll.
Yeah. Yet he did not show himself for the rest of the year. New Orleans eventually settled into its normal routines of making gumbo, drinking, partying, playing jazz. Months went by without a report of the Axeman. People wondered if he might have left the area or if his murderous agenda had been fulfilled. World War I ended and their thoughts turned to other concerns. They were soon to find out that their assumptions about the local killer were wrong.
Oh, I thought you were going to say the Great Depression.
No. It started again on Monday, March 10th, 1919. But this time it was across the river in Gretna, an immigrant suburb. According to reports, screams emerged from the corner of Jefferson and Second Streets. A neighbour, Iolando Giordano, that's a good name, isn't it, ran to help and found a terrible scene. Newspapers did report that it was customers of the grocery store, a couple of kids who found the victims, and there had been no screams. So you can see and hear how reports are fucking flipped over.
They really do like a good yarn, don't they?
And they were like, yeah, it was Iolando Giordano and he heard screams. No, it wasn't. It was two kids and they didn't hear screams. What?
Proper Creole-like fucking theatrics going on here.
Mrs. Rosie caught Miligia, badly wounded and holding a dead two-year-old child, her daughter Mary. Her husband Charles, who was a grocer, lay in a pool of blood on the floor. Rosie said they had been attacked while they slept. Her dead baby had been sleeping in her arms and was killed by a single blow to the back of the head.
Holy shit.
Although Charles had grappled with the attacker, neighbours said that they heard nothing. Fucking neighbour apathy.
Neighbour apathy.
Police combed the house and the immediate area, but found again no evidence. As usual, a panel had been chiselled out of the kitchen door, and it appeared that the attacker had piled timbers by the fence to effect his escape. That's evidence! That's little evidence, please.
Yes.
So I've found no evidence. No evidence, no. There's bloody footprints. There's an axe with fingerprints on it. A picture of the guy saying, I'm the killer. He signed it, left his address.
It's books. Another grocer again.
Yeah, but there's no evidence.
They left a chisel.
Later, police looked for fingerprints, but found none. But they did locate a blood-stained axe beneath the kitchen doorstep.
Why does he keep leaving them behind?
I don't know.
It's really sort of... I mean, I can get the sense
maybe
that,
he's, like running. He's like, this is fucking heavy. Or he's running, and he's like, I don't want to be running with an axe. Because people will be like, we've seen an axe man.
I can see the sort of logic. I'm guessing this is the day before, like, dusting.
Well, they're looking for fingerprints, but he's not leaving
anything. See, because that, like, came in quite... Didn't... Wasn't that about in the, like, Jack the Murder? Like, Jack the Murder, Jack the Ripper. Like, that they did fingerprints. What was that after? When was that? I watched the documentary on that.
I know, like, they did... No, they might. I don't know.
That come in. It was in the 1900s. I know it was in, but it was before the 1900s when it.
Yeah,
come
but
in,
it was
I'm
fucking
sure.
In its infancy, and people didn't believe it. Money was right there in the bedroom, and it wasn't taken. So the robbery did not appear to be the motive. The coroner said that the deed was in fact the act of a maniac. When Rosie Corter Miller recovered from her numerous wounds, which included 5 cuts to the head, she was ready with an accusation. Frank and Orlando Giordano, a father and son who were next door business rivals of Charles, were arrested. Orlando was the person who had come to help, and now he was one of the accused. Unfortunately, he told the coroner's jury a few days earlier that he had had a premonition that something bad was about to befall his neighbour. Charles had said that a white man had attacked him and did name Frank Giordano, according to the newspaper accounts at the time, although several writers insist that he disputed his wife's accusation and even left her over it. Other accounts say that he died in the hospital.
Not mixed accounts here.
You'd think with the... No wonder they didn't fucking find this axe man. They can't even decide if somebody left his wife or if he died. Anyway, Rosie's testimony against the two men at the trial was so persuasive that they were both convicted, despite the fact that Frank's £330 frame could never have fit through the hole in the kitchen door. And that Charles, in fact, if he was still alive, could not identify him as a court, as a prosecutor. It's like, fucking, this there is a corpse. Can you identify this man? Your silence speaks volumes. One witness even said that Rosie had stated directly after the attack that her own husband had done it. But it was clear that he couldn't have inflicted because the wounds on his own words were too bad.
Can't get around like that. Like,
yeah, they were either fatal or not fatal. Who knows? Anyway, in the end, Frank received a death sentence and his father got life in prison.
Seriously? Holy shit. Mm.
Even while the investigation was still in its early stages, another incident occurred that may or may not be linked to the series of attacks. 3 days after the Corter Midgley attack, the editor of the Times Picayune received a letter that would link the axeman, in some people's minds, to an equally notorious set of unsolved slayings. Now, Leslie, London,
Jack
1888.
Jack the Murder.
Over 10 weeks. Jack the Murder brutally murdered 5 prostitutes, often cutting pieces of them out and taking them with him. Now, he wasn't identified as a court, but several letters came to the police during the course of the killings, one of which was signed Jack the Ripper.
God, you fucking
saying
it.
No, I was just saying Jack the Murder.
Jack the Murder.
Another, which appeared to contain a piece of kidney, is said to be from the victims, was unsigned, simply said, from hell, and promised more violence.
And also, it's a good comic.
It's a fucking good comic.
The film...
Not so good.
It doesn't really do much, like, in regards to, like, as a comic book adaptation, no. But it's an alright film.
But the comic book, read it, it's awesome.
Yeah, it's really good.
Now, it seemed the Axeman had written a similar missive. The letter was reprinted in Total and Talent's book in Gumbo Yaya, and in Julie Simon's novel, The Axeman's Jazz. Right, you ready for this? It was dated, Hell, March 13th, 1919. Esteemed mortal, they have never caught me and they never will. They have never seen me, for I am invisible, even as the ether that surrounds your earth. I am not a human being, but a spirit and a fell demon from the hottest hell. I am what you Orleanians and your foolish police call the Axeman.
bit extra of that.
When I see fit, I shall come again and claim other victims. I alone know who they shall be. I shall leave no clue except my bloody axe, besmeared with the blood and brains of him whom I have sent below to keep me company.
May or not be a grocer.
If you wish, you may tell the police not to rile me. Of course, I am a reasonable spirit. I take no offence at the way they have conducted their investigation in the past. In fact, they have been so utterly stupid as to amuse not only me, but his satanic majesty, Francis Joseph, etc. But tell them to be aware. Let them not try to discover what I am, for it were better that they were never born than incur the wrath of the Axeman. I don't think there is any need of such a warning, for I feel sure the police will always dodge me, as they have in the past. They are wise and know how to keep away from all harm. Undoubtedly, you Orlinians think of me as a most horrible murderer, which I am, but I could be much worse if I wanted to. If I wished, I could pay a visit to your city every night. At will, I could slay thousands of your best citizens, for I am in a close relationship with the Angel of Death. We share tea and go for brunch together. It's quite nice. Now, to be exact, at 12:15 earthly time, on next Tuesday night, I am going to visit New Orleans again. In my infinite mercy, I am going to make a proposition to you people. Here it is. I am very fond of jazz music, and I swear by all the devils in the nether regions that every person shall be spared in the home a jazz band is in full swing at the time I have mentioned. If everyone has a jazz band going, well then, so much better for you people. One thing is certain, and that is some of those people who do not jazz it on Tuesday night, if there be any, will get the axe. Well, as I am cold and crave the warmth of my native Tartarus, and it is about time that I leave your earthly home, I will cease my discourse, hoping that thou wilt publish this, and it will go, may go well with thee. I have been, am, and will be the worst spirit that ever existed, either in fact or realm of fantasy. Yeah. So basically, he's the worst demon ever. He's best mates with Satanic Majesty and the Angel of Death, but, you know, those who jazz it up, they're going to be spared his axe.
I feel that maybe, just maybe, this is the most edgy and metal, because that was pretty metal.
That was, yeah.
Fucking jazz promoter in the world.
This guy just wanted jazz.
He just wanted fucking jazz.
You know, like in New Orleans, jazz was on its way out. Bluegrass was coming in. He's like, no, my fucking dead body. I'm going to kill a bunch of people and say I'm a demon.
Watch. And they're all going to be fucking grocers. That'll fuck with people. Yeah. Also, like,
except for that one guy who was a barber.
Barbers and grocers. What I mean, it's like, you start with the small infrastructures. People can't get their fucking beans and are walking around with beards and long hair. It'll all go to shit. And then that's when I'm going to be like, play jazz, fuck bluegrass. Also, I just need to say, what the fuck is it with, like, US law people? Like, because this is the second guy now. Because didn't they, like, fucking say that, like, H.H. Holmes could have possibly being Jack the Ripper. That was definitely bollocks.
Yeah, that was bollocks. Anyway, this letter, whether it was a prank or the real thing, he's like, I'm cold, I'm going to go back to Tartarus. You know, just
Tartarus.
Well, whatever it is. Just fucking write your letter in hell and have it posted.
That's where the Titans are imprisoned in Greek mythology.
Yeah, but can't he just write this letter in hell? Or is it that hot that the paper just burns?
Could be. Yeah. That'd be frustrating.
Yeah. Anyway, people took the letter seriously. It's been said that while the residents of the Big Easy will use any excuse for a party, there has never been a louder, more raucous evening than St. Joseph's Night on March 19th. One host issued the Axeman an invitation promising him 4 scalps, but insisting he abided by protocol. He could come through an open bathroom window, but would he please leave the door alone?
Don't chisel the door.
Just come in and you can kill 4 of us. I mean, I'd keep that guy on a watch list.
I would too. Yeah. That sounds very sacrificial sort of shit. Like, what was he?
But
what was he into?
As no one was murdered that night. They were all jazzing it up.
It's because he wanted jazz.
On 10th of August, another Italian grocer suffered an ordeal. While he slept, Steve Bocca was hit with an axe. He stumbled from his home to get the help from a friend. Although Bocca recovered, he had no memory of the details of the attack. A panel had been chiselled from his door and an axe left in the kitchen. Nothing had been taken. 3 weeks later, on September the 3rd, the axe man, or someone, gained entry to the home of Sarah Lowman, but not through a door panel, Les.
No.
The 19-year-old girl was found unconscious in her bed with multiple wounds to her head. A bloody axe was left outside an open window. I'd keep an eye on that guy who was like, yeah, you know, just come through a window. The next victim was Michael Pepitone on October the 27th. During the early morning hours, his wife heard a struggle in her husband's room, which was adjacent to hers. Managed trouble. She rushed in, nearly colliding with a man fleeing the scene. Mike lay on his own blood with the weapon of an attack clearly being an axe. It was left behind on the back porch. Once again, a panel had been removed from the door. Police, there's a link here.
There's a link here, police.
Their daughter ran for the police, summoning Deputy Ben Corcoran, who found Mrs. Pepitone standing over her husband. It looks like the axe man was here and murdered Mike, she commented. They transported him to Charity Hospital where he died. They're pretty sure this one died, not like got a job and became that little, and this little man came up, went on to become George Bush. Mrs. Pepitone claims she had seen two men in her home, not just one, and both had been large. After attacking her husband,
large,
both had fled, taking nothing with them. Oddly, there were eight people in the house at that time, yet the attackers had not been intimidated by the possibility of being identified. Another odd thing was Mrs. Pepitone had never screamed, and as she answered police questions posed by the police, she didn't appear to be distraught. Different rooms, told you. A newspaper, The States, offered speculation about the killer, wondering whether he was a fiend, a madman, a robber, a sadist, or some supernatural entity. Covering all bases there, aren't you? It was a question that others were asking as well. People had noticed that the door panels being removed from each crime scene were too small for a grown man to get through, nor could he have reached in to unlock the doors. And anyway, the doors were always found locked. How did he get in and out? Unless he was other than human. Superstitions around New Orleans were not uncommon. And as depicted... And as depicted in folklore accounts, people spoke of needle men who stabbed women into unconsciousness and carried them off.
Yeah, but stabbing people into unconsciousness and hitting them with a fucking axe.
Bit different, yeah. Then there were black bottle men who killed patients at the hospital and then gave the body over to medical students. More mysterious was the gown man, who wore a long black gown and rode in a black car looking for girls out alone. Some who feared him believed he was a malicious type of ghost. He was just as likely to jump out of a tree as pull up in his car, similar to that of the domino man in Gentilly, a New Orleans suburb.
So he was a flasher?
No, he was just like a paedophile, really. He wearing a white hooded robe, he'd leap in the midst of a group of girls and send them running.
Right!
Just go like, Rah! And the girls go, ah! He was like, oh, I've fucking got you.
These are really shit folkloric creatures, New Orleans. I expected better. I really expected better. This is wank.
Oh, no. You're ready. Here's a good one. In 1914, somebody dubbed Jack the Clipper managed to cut off the locks of three schoolgirls. Ooh, you bastard.
What a fiend.
Just as cases were reported, the girls began to protect themselves. Jack vanished as quickly as he had come.
They stopped. They stopped, like, wearing their hair in ringlets.
Yeah.
And they tied it up. They wore wimples.
They wore it in a bun. It was no surprise then that when he men in New Orleans...
Jack the fucking Clipper.
I know. So yeah, residents began to speak of the Axeman as a spirit, a devil in their midst, especially when one witness said they had seen him dressed in black, wearing a black slouch hat. He was tall and thin, like most good phantoms always are. It's partly for these reasons that Callia Smith, New Orleans historian and author of Journey into Darkness, Ghosts and Vampires in New Orleans, collects tales about the Axeman. I was interested because I wrote about vampire stories that had been documented in town.
What?
and I was intrigued with the statements from eyewitnesses that the Axeman had disappeared as if he had wings. Then there was this letter about him being a spirit. They never found a murderer, and in some instances there was no signs of a break-in. It was a mysterious rush of murders in the city, and I went with the idea of, what happens if he wasn't actually human? I'm going with the ideas of what happens
clearly if he... Clearly it was the fucking vampire the start.
I'm going with the theory of what happens if he was a pig.
He could have been a pig.
He got through the door, chiselled it out with his snout.
Chiselled it out? Like, or just... Yeah.
Yeah, pig man in New Orleans, there you go. Fucking knobhead.
Just got this idea.
Oh, look at me, I'm a historian.
Just got this
idea. I'm collecting fucking... stories about vampires, so I'm going to say it's a vampire, you prick.
A pig, though, for the fucking god. Like, I just got this image of this, like, little fucking pig getting stuck in the door, like...
like, just squeezing his butt and eating himself up.
And it comes out with a pop, like... and then it goes with a fucking axe in its mouth, yeah. And, like...
just drops the axe. That's why he can't carry the axe.
That's why he can't... Or the chisel... You see, he goes in, this, like, poor piglet goes in thinking, I can chisel away that door.
No, right. The chisel is done by a fucking monkey, right? And then the monkey's like, pig, go in and axe him.
Oh, shit, so it's like a monkey pig rider?
Yeah.
Monkey pig rider?
Yeah. Like, the monkey then rides the pig out there.
Rides the pig out. So, like, the fucking... So, the monkey's there with the axe on its back. And
with
the
fucking fez.
With a fez and a fucking chisel. And, like, he's like, no, the fucking chisel's a diversion, so the pig's like, and, like, the fucking monkey jumps through with the axe, and then it's like, fucking bang, bang!
No, the monkey sends the pig in to do the axing.
Oh, yeah.
That's why there's no fingerprints.
So the pig fucking waits, and then, like, the monkey comes out, like, all fucking, down with the sickness, and jumps on the pig, and they go away, wee, all the way home. And yeah, that's it. Everybody fucking clap now.
Yeah. Kalila Smith, you're full of shit. He was a pig monkey.
Pig monkey rider.
Yeah. Anyway, New Orleans, apparently, she says, New Orleans has a history of people going crazy. In the late 1800s, there was a voodoo craze where people killed each other because they thought someone had put a spell on them. We've had periods like that. It's possible that these could have been by someone who believed that he was superhuman. Homicidally deranged people can have such delusions of grandeur. So can you. Yet he did make a dare that they wouldn't catch him, and they didn't. The murders were never solved. All I know now is that monkey pig thing. I've got to fucking draw that.
You have? I've just thought bollocks. That's going to make a fucking awesome t-shirt. It needs to be, like, drawn in the most, like you know, like fucking Manowar albums.
Tell you what, you draw that. I'll do it in paint for the episode. You draw the t-shirt for me.
Okay.
Right. During the 1980s, when New Orleans was considered the murder capital of the country, this is Kalila Smith still.
Right.
I had hoped to write about these unsolved murders, but I think the story had gotten distorted by fiction writers and some of the facts are embellished. It's hard to know what really happened. You're fucking saying that it's a vampire, you fucking knob. Yet there are some people who say that the Axeman was identified and killed. On December the 7th, 1920, Mrs. Corter Midgley, who had contracted smallpox, apparently had an attack of conscience. She retracted her accusation against the Giordanos, admitting that quite dramatically in the newspaper offices that she'd lied. A saint had visited her, she claimed, and had been instructed to redeem herself. She begged for forgiveness, and both men were released. I love that. A saint came to me. Yeah, I lied. Fucking, you got smallpox, fucking lock her up. Then the police received a report about him. Fucking lock her up, bitch. Incident in New Los Angeles, California, they occurred on December the 2nd. Apparently, Mrs. Mike Pepitone, dressed in black, had accosted a New Orleans resident named Joseph Mumphrey, stepping out from a shadow doorway to shoot him. He dropped dead on the sidewalk and she waiting for the police to come and arrest him. She insisted that she had seen him running from her husband's room the day he was killed. Mumphrey did have a criminal record, and during the hiatus between 1911 and 1918, and from the last murder in 1918 until the first murder in 1919, he'd been in prison. During the time of each of the murders, he'd been free. He had left New Orleans right after Pepitone was killed. Yet aside from Mrs. Pepperton's testimony, there was no evidence that directly linked Mumfrey to any of the crimes. Newton points out that author J. Robert Nash in Blood, Letters and Bad Men fingered Mumfrey as a mafia hitman, but then identifies the flaws in his theory. Despite the number of Italian grocers whom Axman victimised, not all of his victims were grocers and not all were Italian. He also points out that the mafia did not murder women. Mrs. Pepperton served 3 years of a 10-year sentence in Los Angeles and then disappeared. There were no more axe murders in New Orleans. No one knows for sure who the axe man was, apart from me and Les. It was a pig and a monkey working together because they like jazz. And that ends the story of the axe man of New Orleans.
I'm quite sure that is definitely the guy who was in American Horror Story, the asylum. Because they explain away that they sort of kill him in the asylum.
Yeah.
Don't
and,
they?
Yeah, and replace him with a monkey and a pig.
And a monkey and a pig, yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, that was fucking...
Monkey Pig Rider!
It's a fucking weird one, that was, wasn't it? I do like, though, how the police are like, we've got no evidence, apart from all this evidence. Can't find any links, apart from all these links. And people are like, yeah, he died 2 days later.
But he didn't.
Or he could have been half an hour later.
Could have been half an hour. Yeah.
He left his wife, or he died.
It's like, what I like to think, right... is that this motherfucker just had run up a shitload of tabs with grocers.
And he just killed him so he didn't have pay. I'm not paying for my artichokes. But yeah, let us know, guys. What do you think? Do you think it was a pig and a monkey working together in tandem? Or are you just fucking wrong? Vampires. Bollocks.
Vampires. Yeah, I love how it escalated to the point of vampires.
It was always going to go there, wasn't it?
Yeah.
It was always going to go to vampires. But yeah, please let us know. Also, speaking of vampires, our researcher Hannah dressed up as Edward from Twilight for Halloween. And
she sent the funniest fucking video.
She's got her hair all quiffed up and she's like, this is the skin of a killer, Belle. It was fucking amazing.
It fucking floored
me. Well done, Hannah. That was fucking... Mwah. Beautiful. But yeah, guys, please let us know what you think in the comments below. If you do like this, smack that fucking subscribe button.
Smack it like a monkey with a fucking axe.
No, a pig with an axe. A monkey with a chisel. Smack it. Also, smack that like button like an axe murderer vampire. Blah. Why would a vampire need an axe? He wouldn't need an axe. Full of shit.
Maybe it's just... It's a stupid theory. We know what happened.
It was a
fucking monkey pig axe-wielding pig being ridden by a fucking monkey.
Yeah, for jazz. But yeah, let us know what you think. Below. You can get in touch with us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. Email us at enterthedarkpodcast@gmail.com. Also, you can go to patreon.com/enterthedark if you do like what we do and want to support us and pledge. It would be awesome if you did. We're not going to send a monkey pig to you. You know, can't afford a monkey pig. But if you pledge on Patreon, I might be able to buy a crow. They're only 600.
No, actually, just pledge. Just pledge, pledge, pledge. And we will buy...
A monkey pig.
A monkey pig. We'll get a pig.
Get a monkey.
Because I reckon pigs are going to be cheaper than a monkey.
Oh, fuck yeah.
But we're going to need, like, one of them
monkeys. Are going to have to be on the black market.
It's going to have to be... I like the idea of one of them, like... one of them ones, like, off Ace Ventura.
You're like the Joe Exotic of true crime, aren't you, Les?
I'll never financially recover from this.
This is why you need to pledge to Patreon. All the names of our patrons are coming up on the screen now. Please check out our merch stand. I've been Jan. He's been Les. Watch out for Monkey Pig. Take care.
Have a good one.